As Shapiro and I constantly remind each other, America is a land of contradictions, a nation that boasts of its love of freedom and yet loves to incarcerate, a nation of immigrants and yet a nation that loves deportations. Back in 1949, America got particularly serious about deportations, and it was decided to start running a train that was designed solely for the purpose of ridding the country of undesirable aliens. It would travel across the land, pick up people identified for deportation, take them to port where they would be shipped back to wherever they had come from. It started off slow, but the use of the train hastened the process, and between the two world wars, almost 1 million people were deported via the deportation specials. Now, my next guest has been researching these deportation trains for about 14 years and has found out the most remarkable stories behind the people forced onto the trains and deported, from how and why they ended up in America to what went wrong when they got there and how they finished up as, quote, an undesirable alien. My guest's name is Ethan Blue, and he's a senior lecturer in history at the University of Western Australia. His earlier works include the book Doing Time in the Depression, Everyday Life in Texas and California Prisons. But his most recent book is the one we're going to discuss, The Deportation Express, A History of America Through Forced Removal, published by the University of California Press. Ethan, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be with you.
Of course, the train is such a central part of American mythology, isn't it? You know, the railway tracks stitch the country together.
Yeah, that's right. Railroads are really central to American history and American mythology, the sort of the self-image of the United States as this grand continental empire. And so we've got, you know, paintings of the transcontinental railroads as this force of progress and Christianity and civilization across the continent, you know, driving so-called savage Indians from the land and bison, and then replacing them with towns and churches and farms and soon cities. And yeah, so it's really central to the story Americans tell themselves about American history, but then also, I mean, they're really central to American history in that they played a key role in American empire. You know, the trains were central to dispossessing indigenous people of their lands just by delivering the U.S. military across vast distances quickly. The trains also made it possible to move huge numbers of settlers into formerly sovereign indigenous lands and to simply overwhelm First Nation peoples. And then also on the economic front, the trains allowed the vast stretch of the continent and all of its newly freed resources from the land to be moved into global markets. And so this really made the U.S. into the super economic superpower by the early 20th century that it became.
Well, tonight we're not talking about trains bringing people in, but taking them out. When did this wretched train begin operating?
Well, really, the first of the deportation trains, as it becomes really systematized, is around 1914. And that's when, actually as a part of a process to make deportation cheap and efficient and effective, the U.S. started using these deportation trains that made constant circuits around the country. Now, in order to really understand it, you got to back up a little bit to the 1880s. So the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed in 1882. And this was, you know, one of the first really big anti-immigrant restriction laws. Over the next 40 years, more and more of these anti-immigrant laws are passed, but they never really, they say they're trying to stop people from coming into the country, but they never really know what to do with these so-called undesirable people who are already within the country. And so the processes that they have initially are pretty local. They're quite violent. And they're expensive and pretty ad hoc. And so it really becomes systematized in 1914 with the development of this transcontinental deportation circuit.
It's astonishing, isn't it, that the train was used to remove almost 1 million, quote, undesirable aliens between the wars.
Yeah. Well, and actually, not to get ahead of ourselves, but there have been something like 56 million people deported from the United States between the 1890s and the present. And so it's really, this is the genesis of what becomes the truly massive deportation system.
Suddenly I can hear Woody Guthrie singing the Hobo's Lullaby, another part of this totemic role of the railways, of the railway lines. Shipping and taking the hobos, the unemployed, right across the country during the Depression.
That's right.
Extraordinary. Yeah. Okay. Tell us roughly the route of the train. Where did they pick people up and where did they leave them?
Well, the particular route would vary from time to time to time. And the trains really began doing more or less circuits every 6 weeks to every 2 months or so, starting in 1914 and really running through World War II. But the eastbound leg of the trip typically started in Seattle, maybe Portland, maybe San Francisco, and the trains would stop at various cities en route, picking up people who were considered so-called undesirable aliens and who had been somehow captured in the nation's prisons, or hospitals, or workhouses, or mental asylums, and what have you, in cities along the way. And so, the route that I kind of describe in the book starts off in Seattle, goes to Portland, goes to San Francisco, to Denver, to Chicago, to Buffalo, and then it stops in Ellis Island, where these people who have been gathered, who had initially come from across the Atlantic world, these people are then loaded into they're imprisoned at Ellis Island first, then they're loaded onto a steamship and sent across the Atlantic to Liverpool, Le Havre, Naples, and what have you.
I'm sorry, go ahead. No, Ethan, we're not talking the cattle trucks notoriously used to ship Jews and others to the Nazi concentration camps. We're talking Pullman cars.
That's right. These were reconfigured Pullman tourist cars. And so, I mean, they were reconfigured and hardened, as it were, made more into a more a carceral prison car. And so they would be updated with bars drilled across the windows and armed guards. And it was a really quite remarkable dynamic where you had both immigration authorities as armed guards, but then also private guards from Southern Pacific Railroad or the Great Northern Railroad, as well as a prison doctor or a doctor who was aboard the train, not infrequently, because the U.S. wanted to, you know, unlike the more explicitly murderous Nazi regime, the U.S. didn't want you to die necessarily. This was a liberal democracy, even if it was white supremacist and quite brutal in many, many ways. So they didn't necessarily want you to die, but you just couldn't live there.
Now, I'm going to ask you about at least one woman passenger later, but clearly it was overwhelmingly male passengers.
It was a reasonable mix of men and women, but not least because most migration, or a great deal of migration, is labor-driven migration. A great deal of the migration was very much male. I mean, continuing on to the circuit that the train traveled, though, after it made its stop in New York and unloaded Europeans at Ellis Island, the train would turn around and do the westbound journey and pick up people who had been gathered from more or less across America's more colonial travels and colonial dimensions, so from across the Pacific or from across Mexico. And so then the train would turn around, stop at cities across the country, picking up Mexican migrant workers, people from China, from Japan, Korea, South Asians, and so forth. The Mexicans would get kicked out along the Mexican border, and then the train continued on to San Francisco and Angel Island, which was another immigrant detention center, not unlike Ellis Island. And at Angel Island, the folks would get loaded aboard steamships bound for Hong Kong, Kobe, Yokohama, or Calcutta, and so forth.
Now, let's talk about definitions here of undesirability, because clearly the mad, the criminal, the destitute, and the disabled were at the head of the queue.
That's right. And the very, very poor. Simply being poor could be retroactively envisioned as having been, quote unquote, likely to become a public charge at the time of entry. And so this was another disqualifying category. And also political radicalism. If you were considered to have political thoughts that exceeded the permissible boundaries of what constituted appropriate American political thinking, then you were also deportable.
Absolutely extraordinary. Now, you tell the story through the journey of a single train. How on earth did you get all the details of the passengers and staff?
Well, this was, I came to the project when I was doing my research for my first book, and I learned that people were being paroled for deportation. So I was really interested in this idea that you could leave a prison, for example, by promising to leave the country. But then I was doing research into this prison doctor who rode these trains and plays a pretty interesting role in it. And I learned that he rode these trains and he wrote about it in his journals, and he thought it was a hoot for him. I mean, it was this working vacation where he could be an avid eugenicist trying to cleanse the country of so-called undesirable people and get to travel at the same time. So for him, it was a real working vacation. But then I went into the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and I found some of the itineraries that were sent to the earliest deportation agents. And these itineraries would tell the deportation agent, stop in Philadelphia, pick up these three people, here are their case file numbers. Stop in New York, pick up these 11 people, here are their case file numbers, and so on and so forth across the country. And I then went and called up all of their case file numbers and read their case files and read their stories and selected from among their case files and stories the ones that I thought spoke to the most interesting and important conceptual categories around what defines quote-unquote undesirability, as well as that had the most important mixture of global travels.
And Ethan, you found the doctor's diaries.
Yes. This guy named Dr. Leo Stanley, this guy was a piece of work. I first came to learn about him because he was doing, and some listeners may want to plug their ears for this, he was doing testicular implantation experiments on prisoners at San Quentin in California early 20th century. Yeah. As well as being, an avid fan of forced sterilization of the people he considered to be biologically unfit.
We've done programs in the past about how important the whole eugenics movement in the US was and how it inspired the Nazis.
Yep, that's right. That's right. And I think we can see how both of these practices exist. They exist in a different point on this sort of political spectrum in terms of the much more murderous Nazi regime. The United States regime is, as I said, it's not as murderous a regime as the Nazi regime, but it has the same kind of end point of ethnic cleansing and a biologically pure population to reproduce itself as a settler colony into the future.
Tell me about Henry Weiss.
Henry Weiss was one of the first deportation agents. And he's got a really remarkable and tragic story. And I know about him because I was able to get hold of his personnel files. Now, he was born in what was called Constantinople, and he then moved to the United States in 1890 when he was 24. And he was enormously hardworking. He was an upwardly mobile immigrant. He spoke something like 7 languages. He was a really talented person. He married and had kids, got a job as a translator with the Immigration Bureau, and really worked hard, did his best to work his way up the ranks. Now, from the correspondence in his personnel files, it seemed like he really felt like he was getting yanked around a little bit, that other less qualified people than him were getting promoted and he wasn't. But he eventually really made his way in the Immigration Bureau when his superiors said, hey, we can use this guy to tour the insane asylums of Oregon. And because he speaks so many languages, actually, he'd be really good at running these trains. And as I said, he was an enormously hard worker, and he ran the trains for the next 2 years.
I have to ask you to briefly talk about his death, because there's a great irony here.
That's right. So he was aboard the deportation train. He fell ill in Denver, apparently. He was a hard worker, had been injured on the job before, but he just carried on. And he continued on the train, even though he was unwell. And by the time he got to Chicago, he was dying. And a couple of days later, he was dead. His wife wanted to come out and see him. He died before it was possible. And his daughter wound up writing letters saying, hey, to his employer, hey, can you at least help pay to return his body to us here in San Francisco? The Immigration Bureau said that something to the effect of sentiment cannot guide us in this sort of decision. There's no funding has been appropriated for this sort of measure. Nevertheless, the private rail company, which had been making money off of deportation traffic, said, yeah, we'll send his body home for you. But at the end of the day, his family wound up being essentially destitute because their primary breadwinner had just died. This was a really common way for people to really fall into dire poverty at the time. And they threatened essentially to become the kind of public charge that had been loaded aboard her father's train. I mean, they were U.S. citizens, so it was unlikely, but nevertheless, that was the story of him essentially dying as a cog in the machine that he helped build.
Ethan, the story of Minnie Lester and son John.
Oh, yeah, this is such a tragic story. So Minnie Lester was from Birmingham, England, and her husband died there. She moved with her son John to Rochester, New York, where she had some family. Now, she began doing domestic work, as a lot of immigrant women did. Domestic labor was abysmally paid. You were just above poverty, if that. And her son John, who was about 4 years old at the time, she tried to get him into a school. Now, she put him into the Rochester Industrial School. And this was a school in which the children of the so-called dissolute poor would have their children sent, and the boys would learn some sort of industrial labor. The girls would learn to be good domestics. That was what the Rochester school promised. Now, as it turns out, John Lester had some sort of cognitive difference to what we would consider the norm. It may have been epileptic. At the time, they used this basket category of, quote, feeble-mindedness, which was the tremendously capacious category in which any sort of cognitive difference could be fit. But anyway, when Minnie would come home from work to pick up John, you know, sometimes he would be tied to a chair at the industrial school. And this was not okay. So she then applied for what was called a mother's pension to pay for some other kind of caregiving for her son so that she could continue to go to work. The Rochester welfare offices decided that this was a waste of money, that supplying a mother's pension to support an immigrant woman and then her child, who, according to the kind of eugenic theory that we've been talking about, ought not to have been born. This was considered a waste. So the welfare officer reported them to the deportation authorities. They were rounded up and expelled.
I learned from you that the trains were then used to bring Japanese to internment camps, so, and were in effect supplanted by the age of the car and plane. But I have to ask you this. What do you see as the legacy of the deportation specials?
Oh, geez. I mean, the process of mass immigrant detention and mass deportation that we see in the current moment. I mean, these are the real legacies that we have now. And I mean, as you say, the after World War II, the U.S. switches from the age of rail to the age of auto mobility and air travel. So you got the growth of the highway system and airplanes and so forth. And so there's deportation then takes place via airplane and via bus. And these are the new technical systems that take shape to enable the kind of immigration control as well as labor control through really up through the current moment.
Well, before I thank you, we've got to make the obvious point that there's a connection with our own current policy of deportation of undesirable immigrants, and you must see the parallels, Ethan. Ethan, the highest honour this program can endow on a guest is the koala stamp, and I realise I've been a bit mean-spirited with them lately, but you've just won one because I think what you've done is astonishing. Ethan Blue, Senior Lecturer in History at the University of Western Australia and author of The Deportation Express, A History of America Through Forced Removal, published by the University of California Press.